This morning, you heard me talk about and allude to the connection between trauma and codependence and addiction. And I'm very, very proud to say that we have one of the leading authorities, I think, in the world on that topic coming up now to talk with you. Donna Bevan-Lee, Dr. Donna Bevan-Lee, is a respected pioneer in the treatment of addictions, codependency, and trauma with more than 35 years as a psychotherapist and a clinical social worker. Her innovative treatment model offers a combination of individual and group therapy in West Seattle. Dr. Bevan-Lee is a frequent presenter at conferences and universities on domestic violence, addictions, and long-term impact of child abuse. She's a member of the American Academy of Experts in Traumatic Stress and a consultant to the World Health Organization in Geneva, Switzerland. So we are highly honored to have Donna back with us again this year, and I invite you to stand and give her an applause. Much welcome.
Stan. Hey, it's Don.
Are you all turned on?
Yeah. I'm all turned on. Oh, yes, I am.
You have 60 minutes.
I have 60 minutes.
60 minutes. I won't hunt you down. I'll just wait for you.
Well, you know, it's better if you all stand, because then I can't see anybody. Makes me feel safer. I don't think I'm using that. Okay, I'm really happy to be here again, and I told Rick, as long as you'll keep having me, then I'll keep showing up. This year, I was thinking that wanted to do something a little different. I wanted to talk about the impact of the child's developing brain on later codependence, because we all know, I think, after Rick's presentation this morning, that codependence is a disease of the adult. It is not a disease of the child. Okay? People who are codependent are 25 years and older. People who are 25 and under really are emotionally immature. It's their job. Okay, so I wanted to talk about that developing brain and the impact on the developing brain, and I worked and worked, I really did. I mean, usually I can talk about codependence asleep. In fact, I probably do, but after about 8 hours, I realized that, you know, if I'm gonna talk about the developing brain and impact on the brain, it's gonna be a course. It can't be an hour long, because no matter how many ways I tried to put that together, it just can't happen in an hour. So what I've tried to do for you today is to talk about the impact of the child's developing brain, include that in the discussion about how childhood abandonment, abuse, and neglect impacts the child, which then creates addiction. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the treatment of that and how, you know, because I know that you've all heard some of the treatment, but I'm going to also talk about how that impacts the type of treatment that people receive. All right? So I'm just going to go through the addictions that I will be talking about, because I'm going to write them up here, because then I can keep track of myself. Okay, I'm going to talk about alcohol, drugs. Can you read that? Good. I'm getting better. Gambling. Sex. You'll notice I put that into capital letters. Very important. Love, also in caps. Say, debting, spending. Food, both overeating, eating, and anorexia, and then of course the combination with bulimia, and then I'm going to add on to this rage and fear. because I have people ask me all the time, can people get addicted to rage? And so, you know, particularly with rage and fear, this whole concept of how the developing brain is impacted will become more clear. You really cannot get addicted to rage, but your brain gets locked in a cycle at an early age, so that whenever your basal ganglia back here, which is this, you know, kind of, it's a part of the brain that's unconscious, and when it senses there's fear, it, you know, it sends off an alarm to your brain, sends off an alarm to the amygdala, which goes into fight, flight, or freeze. All right? So people who are, quote, addicted to rage, their response as a child was probably going to be anger, the fight response, okay? If somebody was yelling at them or hurting them, abusing them, or even abandoning them, and they were doing it with a lot of anger at the child does two things. One, it picks up the anger energy of the angry adult, and it also, you know, it won't always do this, but it will come back up with its dukes up. And every time it does that, it sets a cycle in motion so that the brain says, whenever that voice happens, whenever that kind of person shows up, whenever somebody's raising their voice at me, that's, it's locked in now. That's going to be my reaction. Now, they're not thinking that. This is all unconscious. Okay? So if you have a child, if you're a child in a family where your fight, flight, or freeze response is being constantly activated, and your response happens to be come up with your dukes up, you will keep doing that for the rest of your life. All right? These reactions in the brain create cycles. So I'm not kidding when I say it happens for the rest of your life. And when people say depression is anger turned inwards, they don't even know that they're saying the truth about that. Because it is inwards. It's just going and going and going. And then what's the response from other people when somebody is doing this? What do? When every time you open your mouth or, you know, somebody, you say, hey, I want to talk to you about that, and there's a rage action, people move away. It becomes a wall of rage. People feel afraid of that wall of rage, and they don't want to stick around. And so they got a wall of rage. They've got the anger going on every time that gets triggered. That's their response. And so they do end up depressed. Nobody wants to be around them. I mean, how long are you going to keep a job if every time somebody wants to talk to you about something unpleasant, you go into a rage attack? Are your children going to want to be hanging out with you? No. Your life is not going to be very pleasant. That creates some depression. Okay? Would to me. Yeah, and I was that person, I think. I know a little bit about that. So, you know, with rage, yes, it is not an addiction. Yes, it is a cycle. And in order to break the cycle, people have to understand where that anger response came from. Now, in the treatment of this codependence, this childhood abandonment, abuse, neglect, child trauma, what we do is, one of the things we do is we go back and we try to uncover all those nasty experiences that people had in their childhood. You know, and when people say, oh, well, you know, I'm over it. No, you're not. Your brain does not get over it, okay? This is a brain event. Every time it happens to you as a child, it's a brain event. Now, I just want to I want to give you an example of how pervasive this is. And, you know, if he's saying that I'm on the cutting edge of treatment, you're on the cutting edge of recovery. And I'll tell you why. The FBI crime statistics guessed, well, they counted their statistics, okay, that 3 million children had been reported as being abused last year, 3 million. Out of those 3 million, 1 million actually were founded. Now, you don't have to raise your hand, although I think it would be really interesting. Because you're all here, unless you're here because, oh, it's raining outside and there's nothing else to do. So I'm going to guess that everybody in here has some codependency issues. Otherwise, it's like you're still trying to figure out how to take care of yourself. So you're in here on a sunny day instead of out there. Anyway, so self-care. So I just, you know, if you feel like it, it would just be interesting. How many in this room did, when you were children and you were being abandoned, abused, or neglected, did anyone call the police? Raise your hand. One, two, three.
If they did call or didn't call?
They did call. So three? Three times out of this whole group of people, the police got called. Out of those three, one would be unfounded based on these statistics. Does that alarm anybody besides me? I mean, it's alarming, but it's also job security. So I'm conflicted about that. You can tell. Maybe. But really, you're on the cutting edge of recovery. What you are doing right now is going to have an impact that is huge. And so for you to stick with it is one of the most important decisions you will ever make. And I am about as dead serious as that, as a heart attack. And I will tell you why. Because your neighbors will interact with you. Your children will be in relationship with you. Your children's friends will be, your house will be the place they come to when it's too dangerous or too lonely at their place. Okay? Some of you might even be in a profession where you interact with children. You might be teachers, you might be social workers, you might be therapists, pediatricians. You will impact children's lives. And these children have an opportunity to start mitigating the impact of their own experience at their home with their trauma. Okay, is anyone in this room remember even 1 hour or 1.5 hour in your childhood where some adult paid attention to you and you thought for maybe that 1 minute or that 1.5 hour that, wow, this person cares what happens. This person cares if I fail my class. This person cares about this wound on my arm. Did anyone have that? Did it have a big impact on you? Absolutely. And so all of you are going to have that impact. And that has a bigger impact on our society as a whole. It gives those children and those adults who are still out there suffering, it gives them hope. So don't forget that when you say, well, do I want to do self-care today? Do I really want to make my own breakfast? Or do I think I'll just go get a scone and a latte? Do I really want to exercise? Do I really want to take care of my body? Do I really want to miss my favorite TV show so that I can get an appropriate amount of sleep? These are things you can just do. Okay, so just think about that when you're doing self-care. Fear is another one. You remember what I said was that when the brain senses that there's danger, all right, it goes right to the Thank you very much. The amygdala. I said, somebody had a pretty something on, and I just, you know, my ADD. Oh, there's a chicken. It's so distressful. It's probably really not ADD. It's just trauma from my childhood. Anyway. So it goes to the amygdala, and it says, you got to either fight, or you got to get the heck out of there, or freeze. Okay? So with a person who has an addiction to fear, what they did, whenever they sensed danger as a child, whatever they did in their brain, I don't know what is happening here. Okay. Whatever they did in their brain was it went back to their amygdala and they froze. This thing is coming up. Well, it is. They froze. And now, whenever they experience, I need to pull that down. Okay. And now, you know, is that working? I hope nobody's taping this. Okay. So now, as you know, when they froze and just like, then they're the ones who, when something happens in their life that their brain says danger, danger, and the alarms go off, they're the ones who freeze. They just can't move. They can't think. They can't get out of the way. They're the ones that can't leave relationships that are abusive. Okay? They're the ones who, you know, it's like the little kid who is, you know, the mother is saying to the kid, look, these kids are taking advantage of you. You've got to get new friends. They're not required for you to be happy and blah, 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 blah. And then the child is living at that house going into freeze mode because someone in the family has made it unsafe for them, and their response is to freeze. They're the ones who, when they are in a bad work situation that they really need to get out of, they're the ones who won't be able to do it. You know, when people say, geez, you know, I try and get out of that situation, and I, you know, I rehearse what I'm going to say, and I have it all down, and I get in there, and I just can't do anything. They've got the loop going to freeze. All right? And then we have the flight. Where they go? They're not there. They're always leaving. You know, when they're addicts, they're the ones who are going to find, they're going to a new job, a new relationship, a new place to live, a new car, a new whatever it is. They're the ones who are going to be getting away all the time. They're also very likely to avoid any kind of conflict. So they'd be conflict avoidant. Like it's like, I'm conflict avoidant. Okay, then your brain must be circling through fright. All right? So whatever you were doing as a child, however you responded to that unsafe environment is probably what happens to you now when you are feeling unsafe or when you are feeling that there is danger. All right? So it really, you know, the reason I'm telling you this is because it's important that you know, and it helps you in your recovery process to know that it absolutely has nothing to do with what you're doing in your conscious mind. So it's just not your fault. It just isn't. It just happens because your brain does it. Now you might say, well, that sounds kind of hopeless. Well, it isn't. What we know, it's the same thing about addictions. Well, like for instance with alcohol, I'll just say. It's like alcoholics start drinking because they lose control over the amount of alcohol they drink. As soon as they start drinking, they're out of control. And you might say the same thing. Well, that sounds hopeless. Well, it is. Unless, of course, you decide not to put that stuff in your mouth. Do you have to wait until you feel like it? Do you know, if an alcoholic is sitting there waking, do I feel like drinking this or not? What do you think they're going to do? Of course they're going to drink it. And so if they're going to stop their alcoholism, they have to decide not to drink. And so basically what we're asking is that we're asking them, everybody, to engage your prefrontal cortex of your brain. This part here, just so you can see, this part here is the only part of your brain that's conscious. When you talk about, or Rick probably talked about, a functional adult, this is where that guy lives, right there. So when you're awake, you want this to be engaged. You want this to be making decisions. This is where decisions are made. This is where you decide what you're going to do that day. For instance, it's a beautiful day. It's opening day of Bodhi season. We haven't seen this kind of day in months and months and months, right? So you're all here because your prefrontal cortex said, A, you paid money. B, that, you know, maybe I can learn something there that's going to help me keep getting better and better and better. Okay? But if your limbic system was going to run the show, which is where your emotions live, it'd look out the window and say, yahoo! I'm hitting the deck, I'm hitting the beach, I'm hitting anything outside is going to find me in it, right? Who cares about anything else? And so when everybody arrives here with their prefrontal cortex going, what we do is we open the blinds and look out there longingly. And we also know that our weathermen, who are always correct, I'd like that job. You can always be wrong and still get paid. this thing is really bad. We get it the same thing tomorrow. So tomorrow we can let our limbic, you know, kind of run the show. So now you're saying, now I'm going to talk about addictions too. All right? So here you are. This is what happens to a child who's in a family that is less than nurturing. All right? And that less than nurturing thing can be abandonment, abuse, neglect, sexual abuse, physical abuse. You know, you can be abandoned in about a million ways. You know, the parent can actually leave the room, leave the state, leave the earth if they die. A parent can abandon a child by, you know, putting the newspaper up in front of their face whenever the kid's in the room. They can turn on the TV. They can go to the computer and start surfing. You get the idea. Parents can abandon children in all kinds of ways. And so what the child does always, because they are egocentric in nature, and they're children, they should be, not 25 or over, okay? So they're egocentric in nature, and they think, must be my fault. Something must be wrong with me. And then when they're told, well, you know, there is something wrong with you, you're bad, you're stupid, you're dumb, you're uninteresting, I only like to go to soccer games that adults are playing because your soccer games are, nobody even knows how to play. Okay, when I'm not interested in you, or when I'm going to beat you up, you know, as a child, you are going to think it's about you. Your brain doesn't know how to do anything else. So you're in a family where you feel unsafe. Now remember, as a baby, has anyone ever seen a newborn? Okay, they're like this, right? Does that look stable? No. Okay, babies aren't stable. They're terrified. They've been in this womb, hanging out in Disneyland, where everything's like, they're bouncing around and punching people out, like their mother's ribs. You know, but they're having a great time. They're fed, they're warm, they're comfortable. And then, boom, you know, they go through this horrific experience where their body has to get squished, and their brain, their head gets squished, and boom, out they go into a big room with all kinds of, they've never been there before. Never been there before. They have no clue what has just happened to them. The only thing they know is that when they hear either mother or father's voice go, "What is it?" Or, "Does it have all its feet and feet, toes, fingers, all of its feet?" And then it goes, I've heard that voice before. Because, of course, there's just a flap of skin between you in the womb and out there. And I don't know about you, but if I put a flap of skin up to my ear, I'm probably going to hear things. Okay? But it's not hearing the words. It doesn't understand what's going on, but it certainly picks up the energy. But it knows. You all came out that way. You had no clue what was going on. And if you were held and caressed, and people was like, "Oh, God, you are the most beautiful. Look at this baby." And every time you looked up, and you, no matter whose face it was happy and joyous, and it was looking right at you, you felt better. Or if you're fed, you felt better. If you were held, you felt better. If you were fed, you felt better. If every face that looked at you was filled with joy, you felt better. You felt good. And as time went on, if those faces that kept looking at you were filled with joy every time they look at you, then eventually you'll do the same thing. Must be about me. Right? We call that self-esteem. If you don't get that coming back to you, you didn't get the self-esteem. What you did was that when it wasn't coming to you, you said, "What do I need to do to get that? Okay, what do I need to do? What do I need to say? How can I be perfect? Oh, and if I'm not perfect, I'll never be good enough." Any perfectionists in the room? Okay, now you know. It wasn't coming to you. I got to do it better. I got to do it perfect. If it's not perfect, it's not good enough. I'm trying to determine based on my anticipation of those parents' reaction to me. Based on that anticipation, I have to decide what I need to do next to get that positive coming. If you grow up in an unsafe family, you are always anticipating what your parents' next feeling would be. And then two things happen. One is that you're trying to figure out how to get that to change and make it better. The other thing that happened was that you started to mirror that, and you would start to have the same reaction that they did. So that pretty soon, again, your brain is doing this. You're cycling through a cycle of emotional reality that probably doesn't belong to you. And you're dysregulated at that. Because you're sitting in here on the floor just dandy. Mom comes in. She's really bad. You anticipate that. You see the look on her face. And you think, "It's me." So all of a sudden, the only thing that happened was that Mom walked in the door. Now you're in distress. Happy, distressed. Happy, distressed. This is called emotional dysregulation. And when you have a parent who's emotionally dysregulated, and what that means is that you're just going up and down and up and down and up and down, you have a child who either gets, well, For what we're talking about, addictions, that child will also be emotionally dysregulated. I'm going to talk about the one that doesn't, that just goes zip, and they become so controlled. At some point, the experience of living in that little body, having that happen over and over and over again, becomes so unbearable that that child has to find something to distract themselves. And when you're a child, a little child, or a, you know, you can find things to distract yourself from that big on. You can use food, and you can use sex. You can start to, you know, because, here's one that you've probably never heard. So the child is emotionally dysregulated because the grown-up is emotionally dysregulated. When the child starts crying, here, eat this. This will make you feel better. Here, eat this. This will make you feel better. So what happens is that then the child learns that when I am dysregulated and my brain is telling me, eat that, it'll make you feel better. Because back then, it did. But then as an adult, it doesn't. It maybe will for a minute, but the self-hatred comes in right after. So, and sex. Little children can fondle themselves and be completely distracted from what's going on. So what do? As soon as they get dysregulated, they go for their privates and they feel much better, thank you very much. Now, these are two things that are happening in your brain. By the time you're 10 years old, this is just patterned behavior. Your brain is just recounting all of these reactions to you so that whenever you feel those ways, you're automatically going to be going for that thing that is going to make you feel better. Then you're a child in this unsafe environment. And remember, you started out not knowing a darn thing. So you're baffled and confused probably by now because you might have noticed that other people don't have families like yours, that other people's moms are nicer, that other people's dads are present, that somebody's parents don't drive them while they're drinking. Okay, you probably noticed this. So you start getting a little bit confused as to why can't I make this happen for me? Periodically, you're going to be asking yourself, what do I need to do to make that stop? What do I need to do? If I get better grades, if I get better at sports, if I get better friends, if I go to bed on time, nothing makes it stop. But see, you're a child, so of course you think it's all about you. You're a child. Then, one of my personal favorites up here. Then you find about nicotine. You know, usually that comes about, you know, if you're looking for something to make you feel better, there's cigarettes. Now, cigarettes, nicotine is, and caffeine are probably the two most everyday addictions we have. They're easily accessible. They're, you know, in around here, smoking isn't that accepted, but nobody throws you in jail for it. Caffeine, yeah, it's accepted. That's how we keep ourselves from killing ourselves in the wintertime up here. With all that darkness out there. Jeez. Anyway, seriously. So, we find nicotine. Now, nicotine all by itself is addictive. But what really gets the kid going is that they got to find out how to get it. So they're trying to figure out, okay, if my mom or dad smokes, and that might be more simple. But, you know, it's like, how do I sneak around, and can I steal it from the store and everything? You can tell I lived a long time ago when you could actually steal cigarettes from the store. Now you have to, you know, have some kind of password or special card or something that gets you into that thing. Of course, you can go down the aisle and stick a fifth of whiskey in your... Anyway, well, you know, I don't need to editorialize about this. I mean, I would, but I won't. And then you find marijuana. No. You know, I know marijuana, it's like all of a sudden, okay, you got to go out and find that. Well, it used to be that you'd have to figure out how to get it. Now you can get it. and you can walk around and smoke it with impunity. That's such good news. Anyway, so that distracts the crap out of you. You got to find out where to get it, then you do it, and then you're trying to figure out, does it do anything for me or not? You know, and then you got to, you know, look at your friends and see, what's it doing to them? You know, does anybody remember smoking marijuana? The first time it was usually like, okay, what's the big deal? But your friends will let you know. And then you find other drugs. You know, maybe you found your mother's or your father's benzodiazepines. They're narcotics. You find out that, oh, these make me feel different. These make me feel better. And part of that is just the danger that you put yourself in as a child trying to get access to these things that nobody lets you have, right? And then alcohol is one of the favorites of every adolescent, you know, and most adults. It's like, that is really accessible. You know, it's like most people who become alcoholics had parents who drank. So what, their parents lock up the booze when they left home? No. It was in the fridge. It was in the booze. You know, it's like, oh, we'll put it up here and the kids can't get it. Right. I mean, I grew up Mormon. We could get it. For crying out loud. It's so easy. And now you can get it at the grocery store, at Walgreens. I mean, come on. So then, but if eventually what happens is that the kid that's growing up in this environment is finding many, many ways to distract themselves from this intolerable reality that they live in. And in all seriousness, these children feel like, I am not important. I don't matter to anybody. I'm a pain in someone's ass. I'm driving someone crazy. I'm trying to kill my mother or father. I'm supposed to be teaching my siblings what to do and how to do it, and where have I learned it? Okay? What the heck? So, yeah, I'm looking for a way to make myself feel better because I am just stuck in this. I'm not good enough. I'm afraid, I'm fighting, I'm freezing, I'm trying to determine how I'm going to live through this. So I'm just opting out. Then I can find gambling. And you know, with the advent of the internet, you know, I'm so happy that we have that. Because gambling you can do now, I don't care how old you are. You get online and gamble your parents' house away. I mean, I don't know if that's true because I've never done it, but I've sure heard people tell me that, you know, they can stop going to Tulalip and all the other places, but who can live without the internet these days? You know, it's what we all kind of, you know, we rely on that so much. And so people who have trouble with gambling, it's like they get on the internet to check their email, and the next thing you know, something's coming up for them to gamble. And then sex, oh, don't get me started here, but I will. Okay, sex addiction. When I was a young therapist back in the early 70s, the word didn't exist, okay? All these other things, yeah, we kind of already knew there was something going on with a lot of them, but sex addiction and love addiction didn't, you know, it didn't happen. If you were a sex addict back in the 70s, and you were acting out, you were either in San Francisco or New York or Miami and were a gay man, okay? Because they were acting out and suffered immensely for it. And of course, who's learning from that? And if you were a porn addict, all right, you had to go get up out of your house, go into a store, buy a book. And now how fast can you look at those pages and get anything out of it? I mean, really? Or it would come to your house in a, you know, in a paper bag thing. Nobody knew, right? What else arrives in paper? Anyway, so, you know, what are you going to do anything? You got to keep turning the page. internet comes along. Click, 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 click. You can put those images into your brain so fast. And all those neural pathways that we have, that every time we do anything, we're either in an old neural pathway or creating a new one. If you're sitting there looking at internet pornography, every time you hit a new image, you click on a new image, that pathway is bigger and bigger and bigger and more excited, more excited, until finally your brain on a PET scan is going to look just like a meth brain, just like it. It's all red and yellow and orange, and it's all jagged like this. That's what your brain looks like on porno, especially internet pornography. And the only other brain that looks like that on a PET scan is a meth brain. And then good things happen, like, okay, so you're a porn addict and your wife or your partner's over there going, hey, you do have a partner here who's willing to be sexual with you. So you finally go over there. Your arousal has been hijacked by the internet. So you go over and you think, well, maybe if I just start, maybe something will happen. Well, maybe I can get her to watch internet pornography with me. Maybe I can get him to watch internet pornography with me. It shuts your normal sexual response down. It hijacks it. And, you know, it's hard to get that back, I'll tell you, right now. It takes a lot of work. And when a person is going through sex addiction withdrawal, it is a nightmare. It is a nightmare, and it lasts. It can last up to 90 days to withdraw from sex addiction. Now we have pornography, and then people get these really interesting ideas about what to do with their partners, and their partners are going, nope, that's not happening. So then it's a relationship issue, right? And then she's feeling, I could go off on that for about 3 hours or a whole course, but I won't. Anyway, sex addiction is another addiction. It started in babyhood. All right? So these are serious addictions. Another addiction. Now, I want to get to, I'm going to take a minute to talk about this. Love addiction. All these addictions, not these, because these aren't addictions, but these, this, and that up. They're all ways that the child is young adult, and then eventually adult, is trying to distract themselves from how horrible they feel, from how frightened they are, from how unloved they feel, from how lonely they are, from the pain they're in. We call it self-medicating for a reason, right? But the love addict, love addiction is a natural consequence of all of this. It is not a distraction. So when you've got the child who's sitting there, distract, distract, I got to find another way to distract, distract, there's always that child that is sitting there, I got my eyes on you, and I'm not taking them off. And I'm watching everything you do, and I'm watching everything you say, and I'm trying to sit over there and figure out what I'm going to do to get that love from you, that attention, that direction, that approval from you. I'm not distracting at all, okay? I've got my eyes on you all the time. That's where I'm focused. And I'll tell you what. So this isn't a distraction. What this is, it again, the impact on the developing brain is unbelievably destructive. For love addicts, there is even a question about reality. I mean, an adult person who is saying, if I'm a love addict, is the love real? Don't even know. How do you know if you have love? The first time you know that you have love is when your parent tells you, I love you. You are so precious to me. You are the most important person in my life. I won't leave you. I'll be here with you. You can always come to me. And indeed, every time they, you know, it's like, there they are. And even if you do something really bad, these parents, right? These parents that are not causing this distress. This is the key. Whenever they're around the child, their emotions are not dysregulated. They're stable. So that even if, you know, I have a great example. Great example of this, where I saw this. And this was before codependence was a word. But I remembered it, and I thought, that's that. We just kind of knew that. I worked in emergency rooms, two major hospitals. And one of the things I did was when there was an emergency in the emergency room, a person came in who was traumatized, their people would be sent to me when they came to the ER. Okay? So, and then I would debrief them, and I would help them talk about what was going on and their fears, and I would give them information about what was going on. You know, it's just, it was a big, kind of a big, you know, job with a lot of variety. One day, a 10-year-old girl was brought into the emergency room by ambulance, and she was severely traumatized by a gang rape that had happened to her. And she stopped in the ER long enough for them to determine that she's going to the OR right now because she was bleeding, she was hemorrhaging. And so they just took her to the OR, and when her parents came, the father walked in. They were both just kind of like, what is happening here, of course? And then when I was able to explain to them what had happened and what was happening now and that their daughter was in the OR and blah, 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 and the father started getting really angry. Who did this? Who did this to my daughter? I'm going to go out there. I'm going to kill him. I believed him, you know, wouldn't you? The mother was just, you know, wringing her hands. She was like, oh, my God, I should have. Like, she could have stopped it, right? She was at home with the children. And she was just sure that, you know, it was all her fault. She should have. And then she'd kind of, you know, melt down into a bucket of tears. And the father, of course, he wasn't crying. He was going to go out and kill the SOB. Of course, tears were jumping out of his eyes, just jumping. And mother was melting down. And so we did that for a while, a couple hours. And finally, the surgeon came in, and he sat down with us, and he said, well, you know, we had to do this and that, and, you know, she had a hysterectomy, and he said, we had to do all this stuff. She's in ICU. We don't know, you know, the next 24 hours are going to tell us what's going to happen. And so one of them said to me, and this is a mother, what are we going to do? And what I told her, I said, whatever you've been doing in here, do it somewhere else, not in front of your child. Now, they were really dysregulated, okay? Who wouldn't be, right? I said, do it in the ballpark. Do it at, go call your pastor and do it with him. Do it with your book club. I don't care where you do it, but not in front of her. I said, because what she's looking at, she's gauging, and we all do this. We did this as kids, and we do it, you know, when we're in our codependence, unless somebody has a gun or something on us, where I'm doing this, if they do. But, you know, most of the time, children are doing this to determine how they're going to respond. What they'll just pick right up on that emotion, and they will have it with the parent. So if the parent is dysregulated, so will the child be dysregulated. And they'll go up and down like that all the time. And he said, well, how are we going to do that? I said, what you do is you go and yell and scream and hit baseballs and do whatever you got to do. And then when you're with your child, you sit there and you comfort her. And you say, honey, we're going to get you through this. This is what parents do. You didn't cause it. We didn't cause it. Bad people caused it. Seriously, codependent people caused it. And honey, you're going to be okay. We aren't leaving your side. First thing, safety. She feels safe. Because the cops come in and says, don't worry, we're here. Do you feel safe? If you're a child, heavens no. The nurse comes in, says, you'll feel safe, you're going to be okay. You don't believe anybody. But if mommy and daddy come in and they say, honey, you're safe. I mean, did you all just feel that? You feel safe. Now you're not dysregulated. Now you can get back to the business of healing. You see? That's how important it is for when you're looking back on your own history to see, how are those people acting? What was I thinking about myself? Was I thinking that I was valuable, that my parents were also happy to have me there? Did they think I was the most valuable asset in their lives? Did they say to me, and did they follow up, honey, I am here for you. Whatever you need, I'm here. Understand there's another side of codependence, and it's the better than. The better than has nothing to do with love, time, and attention. The better than has to do with, well, honey, you're better than everyone else. You don't have to go by the same rules. Those rules are for those people out there who need them. You don't. You're perfect. And then you as a child gets to control the family. Okay? That's a bad thing. Most of the time, that's not what people are here for, but sometimes it is. Because it is abusive to children. They grow up, and what are they? Who wants to be around this? Anybody you know? No, they're lonely. And they don't even have enough ability to look inside and say, could it be me? They can't do that because they start out with the premise that it isn't. It's everyone else, no matter what. Now, if you can be regulated, and that's part of the recovery from codependence, it starts with self-esteem. I have value. I give this every year, so if you've heard it one time, you'll hear it some more, okay? These are some of the ways that you can start today to start regulating yourself, to get modulated, to get grown into an adult reality. Self-esteem, you can say, every person you meet, what do I have in common with that person? Not, am I better than or less than? Because, you know, when you're in that, it's like, okay, if you're in a crowd, you're just better than, less than, better. Oh, well, I'm better than that person, less than that person, and what am I going to do? So how are we alike? What do we have in common? Around the issue of reality, you can say, I'm not going to say I don't know ever again in my whole adult life. Because I know. And I'm not going to let my brain hijack me and say, I know, but I'm not going to tell you. I'm going to say it. If you ask me, how are you doing? I'm going to say, well, let's see, how am I doing? How am I feeling? What am I doing? You know, I'm going to answer you. If you say, do you want to go to a movie? I'm going to say yes or no. Not, well, I don't know. Now, I do think you can say something like, I'll get back to you on that in a few minutes. Take I don't know out of your vocabulary. You're an adult. You know what you feel. You got to know. If you don't, start learning. So that's reality. Moderation. If you don't know what it is, because people who don't know what it is have to guess, okay? Stop guessing. And find at least one or two people that you see that they're kind of moderate. I think I'll ask them. And do that on a regular basis. Of course, tell them first. Otherwise, it might be kind of a weird conversation. Knowing what your adult needs and wants are and getting them met appropriately What you do is you go home, you write down, here's my needs, here's my wants. If your list of needs is long, then you're not in your adult reality. You're in your child reality. See, children are needy. It's their nature. It's their job. Once you're over 25, your need list should be about this big. Your wants list could be as long as you want. Okay? But when you're looking to have your needs met by your significant others, by your friends, whatever, make sure that they're needs. You know, if there are things like, well, I need you. Okay, first of all, that's not your need. That would be called, I'm acting like a love addict with you. I need you to be X, Y, or Z in order for me to be okay. I need this to be off my head. So if I say, though, that I need a job so that I can support myself and my child, okay, that works. I need 8 hours of sleep, absolutely. You don't want to see me if I don't have it. I need to eat good food. Would I like somebody to tell me the truth? Yes. It's not my job if they do or not. Because I want to have boundaries. Boundaries is a system of self-containment. Here I am, self-contained. My stuff is inside. I'm going to decide what I leak out on you, or I'll decide what I tell you, or I'll decide how I act with you. That makes me have boundaries. That makes me self-contained. The other part is you. I keep your stuff out there. I don't need to take it on. Now, if you're a therapist and you don't have this, you will burn out soon. If you're a nurse and you don't have this, you will burn out. If you're a teacher and you don't have this, you will burn out. Because when you're working with people, without this, poop all day on you. You don't want that. No, people say, you know, it's like police officers. Can you imagine with no boundaries? Bad. And wonder why. Oh, they kick someone in the head. Okay. All right. So, you know, boundaries. It's like boundary chi. Here it is. Out there's yours and here's mine. And here is another quick hint for you with boundaries. Because if you can get this down, you're in good shape. If you're not thinking about your boundaries, if your prefrontal cortex has not been engaged with boundaries, they are not there. They're not there. It's an experience that happens in your mind. What you think and feel about me is none of my business. Yes. And the minute that I say things like, well, I don't care, oh, I've made it my business. It's none of my business. If it's none of my business, I'm just like, oh, well, isn't that interesting that you're having that experience about me? It is absolutely essential that I be responsible for the impact of my behavior. That's what I'm responsible for. Not your feelings, not your thoughts, not your experience. My behavior. If I walked up and kicked you, I am absolutely responsible for doing that. And I need to be accountable. And I need to make amends and make it right. But the rest of it is not my deal. Now, once you realize that and you have that on board, you really are free to go about the world and do whatever you need to do. As long as you're not hurting other people, you can do whatever you want to do, and so can they. And if you want to be in a relationship that's dynamic, meaning that there are two people giving and interacting and all that, you got to have boundaries. Otherwise, you just become the same person. Well, if I'm going to be in a relationship with the same person, I'll just be alone, thank you very much. I mean, really, there is no way to interrelate. Does that mean it's over? That means it's over. Huh? 2 minutes. I have the 2 minute whistle. Okay. What can I say in 2 minutes that I haven't already said? Well, I do want to tell you one thing. When I said that you really are on the cutting edge of recovery, don't stop doing this. Keep working on your codependence recovery. You will impact every person that you meet in such a positive way, and they will impact others. And when there's children around, I don't care where they are, if they're within sight of you, smile at them. You know, if they're standing there, talk to them. Say, you are a delightful child. They might not have ever heard it before. This has a huge impact. That, and the other thing is that you absolutely have a right to have a joyful experience here. And that means that you have all your feelings, that you're able to express them, and that's where your motivation and your determination comes from. All your emotional experiences, all of your emotional reality, the rainbow of your soul. Get to know them. Get to know those emotions really well. That's what makes you a vivacious person. You all deserve that. Okay, thank you. Is there time? Okay. She said I have to take questions for 3 minutes.
Okay, good.
Okay.
So, you sit down.
So I have questions for about 3 minutes, she said. She said. And then I'll be out in the foyer for a while if anybody wants to talk to me. I'll be glad to talk to you. So, any questions? Yes.
Are there times to figure this out? I understand everything you say, but what if your family is...
That's okay, I'll repeat it for her. Go ahead.
What if your family is incredibly narcissistic, but not overtly abusive?
Uh-huh.
They don't hurt you, they do all the right things, but they're totally narcissistic people. How does that go into the same? I've tried to make that link because mm-hmm. I wasn't treated abusively in an overt way, but I have totally narcissistic parents who it all had to be about them and they could never be wrong.
That's what we call abandonment and neglect.
Okay.
Okay? And so your work will be around abandonment and neglect, and sometimes that's really hard work. At least if you're abused in some way, you
right.
can say, oh, I was abused, and everybody goes, oh, yeah, that's terrible. But if you say, well, I was abandoned and neglected, it's kind of like, well, did you get food?
Right.
It's like that emotional neglect is what stops you from being able to mature. And here's something, if I haven't alarmed you enough, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the next one that's coming out, doesn't have narcissistic personality disorder in it. You know why? It's no longer abnormal. But we know what it is, don't we? So when we go into the therapist, we'll be able to say that my parents were totally narcissistic, and your therapist will be able to say they abandoned and neglected you, and then you can get to work.
There's
a book that relates to the narcissistic parent. And if you may have heard of this, the drama of the gifted child, that's one. And then the, you know, like Pia's book, Facing Codependence, is another one. And, you know, one of my patients is no longer with me. She's still alive. And she wanted to write, she's a really good writer, and she wanted to write a book about neglect and abandonment. And after a while, I said, well, bring it in to me and show me what you've done. She brought in an empty book. It's hard to write about. You know, I think the best way to do it, if you ever want to do the world a favor, is write about your own. specifically, okay? Like, my mother showed up for my 50th birthday on my 49th birthday. Things like that. That kind of has a narcissistic flavor to it.